guilty verdicts for Katrina Brown and Reggie Brown, President Trump and Governor DeSantis at the Villages, and a plan to pay off JEA's pension liability if and when the utility is sold. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect. I'm A.G. Gankarski, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, all the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Roundtable. 549-2937 is your calls. Please call now. Then later, a look at Silence the Musical, which is based on The Silence of the Lambs. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy news week, we welcome Nate Monroe, columnist of the Florida Times Union. Hello, Nate.
Hey.
Shelton Hall of Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And Ann Schindler of First Coast News is in transit. Lots to talk about this week, everything in the news, but we're going to begin with the Katrina Brown and Reggie Brown verdicts. Both ex-city council members were convicted on dozens of fraud charges tied to the misuse of loan money for a factory project tied to Katrina Brown's family business, sort of a BBQ Blue situation. Nate Monroe, you were in that trial. Go ahead and explain the details of that.
Yeah, so, you know, just as you said, before Katrina Brown was on the city council, she sort of made her bones as a member of a family affiliated with a somewhat well-known local barbecue company. And the family had this kind of grand plan to start making barbecue sauce, and got a loan from the Small Business Administration, got a loan and a grant from City Hall to build a barbecue sauce factory. And at the time when this was struck, I mean, this got some media attention. You know, I remember Corrine Brown doing some sort of a media event there. This was going to create 56 jobs in a dispossessed part of town. You know, this was seemed to be a promising black-owned business. It would have been a really good story. What prosecutors say is that in the intervening years, you know, Katrina Brown gets elected to the city council, in part trading on this reputation that she has as a business owner. That she used the Small Business Administration loan and her company is just kind of a money laundering scheme that she, along with a fellow council member, essentially took draws on the federal loan, which was about $3 million, and, said 20 grand was going to be spent on, you know, some sort of conveyor belt system. Well, that money never did get spent on a conveyor belt system. It ended up shuffling around between accounts of Reggie Brown and Katrina Brown that they just, you know, she was claiming that this money was going toward work that wasn't done. You know, prosecutors totaled at least about $250,000 of specific draws on that loan that were allegedly for things in this factory that actually never got done.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, economic development incentives, it's part of the business of politics. You know, Tim Gibbons, you were in City Hall at the time. You know, tell us about that process, sort of the economic incentive process, and sort of, you know, the safeguards that may have ensured that this couldn't have happened.
Right. Well, this is, you know, covering both business and politics. It's interesting to see them converge. And I think that the bit that you're getting at there, I think, is one of the lessons to examine about this, that this is not necessarily a failure of programs like this. Frankly, if we want these, you know, areas of town like this to be developed, it's going to take things like SBA loans and city grants. In some ways, the process worked when you see people who committed fairly basic fraud being let off in handcuffs. I mean, I'm not saying it worked as in you want that to happen, but the idea is that if you are getting grants like this, if you're getting loans like this, it eventually will catch up with you. One of the things I find fascinating about it, not knowing what was in either of the Browns' heads, but this is just like a pure, uncomplicated fraud. You know, you look around at a lot of the you know, big national sort of, you know, the WeWork sort of situations where people say, you know, is that fraudulent? Where it's complicated. This isn't. They got the money, they didn't buy the equipment. It's not like they were, you know, just, you know, having the business run badly. They just weren't doing anything.
Yeah. And you know, when you look at that, Shelton Hall, when you look at, you know, sort of city oversight, this kind of spanned, you know, three administrations here, you know, what What message does it send, you know, to people in the community when economic development funds are misused like this?
Well, given the trajectory of what's been going on the last few years, I think people would think that it's business as usual. The tragic thing about this, besides the undoing of these two, you know, really talented politicians, people who could have gone as far as they wanted, is that it kind of reminds me of the Kareem Brown situation in that our lawmakers don't seem able to execute, as Tim said, elementary frauds, just basic frauds. You know, it's speaking to business as usual, that's how it's been done in Florida for many years. Not to say it's right or that it's not right, but there's Katrina Brown, Reggie Brown, Kareem Brown. There was no reason for any of them to ever take a conviction except that they poorly executed a kind of scam that hundreds of people like them have done all over this country for decades.
Is there a double standard, though? I mean, it's, you know, we're talking about African-American Democrats. They go down in the city, the Browns. Reggie Fulwood had his trial. Before that, Tony Nelson, Donald Gaffney. Why don't white Republicans get affected this way?
I think their methodology is better. They're better at having more steps between, you know, this source of the money and where the money is being taken out. They're better at having shell companies, better at having proxies, better at having legal advice to know how to, you know, like I've always said, the campaign finance process is essentially legalized money laundering. And that extends to a lot of this other stuff. And with these candidates that have been in trouble, a lot of it also is they already had heat on them to begin with. So maybe slow down on the scam when you're trending on Twitter. You know, don't make the ATM withdrawal that day. Send someone else with your car to go make the withdrawal.
Right. You mentioned Tony Nelson. That goes back into in the history a bit. But it's a useful illustration of a point you were just making where he was basically convicted of using his position on the port board to benefit companies he was involved with. And there was some kickbacks in there, if memory serves. And one of his defenses basically were other people were doing it. They had just gone to, city attorneys and gotten it signed off on what they were doing. And he hadn't, but they were essentially the same. And his argument was if it was a white port board member, they could do it because they basically tick the boxes, but the root behavior was the same. That argument doesn't necessarily, I mean, all that says is, you know, as my mom said, two wrongs don't make a right, but it is a valid question in Jacksonville politics. But
as I recall, the judge in that case actually considered that question and did not dismiss it outright. Others who were identified as engaging in the same behavior, I think, came really close to getting in trouble themselves.
Yep. Yeah, I want to get Ann Schindler in. Ann was in this trial. She was also in the Kareem Brown trial. Can you discuss the similarities and differences between the two trials a little bit in terms of the way that the accused defended themselves?
Well, I mean, what was so unusual in this case, of course, was that Katrina Brown chose to represent herself, which was a little bit of a spectacle the judge thought that she handled herself rather ably. I don't think a lot of spectators thought that. I think that it looked like a struggle. It felt like a struggle watching it. Knowing the rules of court procedure, it just doesn't come naturally. Even if you're a smart person and, you know, have some sense about the evidence, which she clearly was very familiar with the evidence in the case. But knowing how to introduce, you know, evidentiary pieces of, she was throwing up documents and pictures that weren't introduced into evidence. And she was constantly being called to sidebar to be sort of chastised or corrected by the judge. So there was, watching that was a little bit difficult. Reggie Brown, of course, had a professional attorney representing him, but, you know, the outcome was the same. The evidence was really overwhelming. And I think the deal is in federal court, basically, if you're there, you know, there's a 90% chance you're going to be convicted.
More than that, 98.
Yeah. I mean, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're really buttoned up. By the time the feds bring a case, they have essentially tried it internally and know that they can prove the case.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think it's worth just sort of pausing for a second on something that others have mentioned. I mean, the crude nature of this scheme really cannot be like overstated. There were witnesses in this trial who testified that they cashed checks drawn on this federal loan and then just handed the money to Katrina Brown. And Katrina would tell the bank that these couriers were vendors who were like doing, you know, installing equipment in the warehouse. I mean, it was just this, I mean, it was really a blatant fraud. This was not a case where I, you know, as a spectator, that there seemed to be many close questions of law.
It wasn't terribly sophisticated fraud.
No.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, a little bit more to talk about. We've got a caller on hold, Chuck from the Beaches. Chuck, welcome to First Coast Connect. Tell us what's on your mind. Go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, okay, guys. Hey, sorry about that. I want to talk about the sentencing assignments. Everybody's been talking about years and years and years in prison. I want to suggest that maybe, because they're not violent, and we've had this discussion for years now about people being put in jail and spending money, yada, yada. What about house arrest, ankle bracelets, community service, fines, maybe 30 days in jail? We don't need to be filling our prisons up with people that are nonviolent.
Okay, so even though they expropriated hundreds of thousands of dollars, $3.2 million in loans and grants, a short jail stretch and house arrest is your suggestion?
Well, I'm saying that, yes, I think that you can make someone not want to do this if you put them on house arrest for 2 years, ankle bracelets, fines, make them do community service for 2 years, and financially fine them. That's serious business.
Okay.
And that's a deterrent. Thank you.
Thank you, Shelton, what do you think about that? A 30-day sentence for $2.6 million is pretty good, huh?
Well, I would, if I were them, I would love to have it. I'd be in favor of house arrest, ankle monitors. I think, really, they've done enough community service at this point.
Yeah, maybe so. You know, and Nate, tell us about sentencing. Obviously, sentencing's January 27th. You know, what do you expect out of this? Karine Brown got 5 years.
Right. And what did she have, 18 counts? We're looking at now kind of 37, 33 counts that they were convicted of.
Right.
I guess you expect that it would be somewhere in that ballpark, right? I'd think that prosecutors, when they are, you know, suggesting appropriate sentences, judges, when they're making their sentences, are looking at prior contextual cases like the Karine Brown case to say, well, this is a, you know, high profile case, a federal corruption case. And I don't think that they can deviate tremendously from that standard. So if Karine Brown got 5 years, I don't think you would expect to see something wildly different from that. But there really is no way to know. You know, the judge in this case was very deferential following the verdict. She said she wanted to come down and shake each of their hands. So she has kind of this, you know, human emotional connection with them post-verdict, which I think is really unusual. You don't typically see a judge say they want to come down and touch the defendant in any way. So that was, you know, I think whatever Katrina Brown's legal strategy, whether that failed or succeeded, I think that there is an argument to be made that it humanized her in a way to the judge, whether it was through her kind of somewhat fumbling defense or, you know, just her being there alone, representing herself in the courtroom and kind of the courage that it took, whether it was smart or not, to do that, I think that that may reach the judge on some level.
Nate, your thoughts?
Well, also, you know, the judge, you know, crediting Katrina with, you know, a relatively able defense and, you know, professing this reverence for the process, that protects the verdict on appeal. Giving the defendant the benefit of the doubt every way. That, I mean, it is like arguably in the judge's interest to defend the integrity of the process there. Like Ann was saying, I mean, federal court uses a point system and judges can decide whether there are aggravating factors that justify using the higher end of a sentencing guideline or whether there are mitigating factors and you know that can decrease the sentence. I would expect something around the 5 year mark, just given, I mean, the amount of money involved. I mean, we are talking about a $3 million loan. That's more money than Karine Brown was accused of misusing.
Yeah.
So
And to keep things in frame, I mean, it's nowhere near as close as the $36 million that disappeared on the shipyards, right?
Well, sure.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you know.
Yeah. You know, Tim, when you look at this, though, I mean, you know, one thing that gets demonstrated or not is contrition. I mean, Reggie Fullwood, when he got popped a couple years ago, he demonstrated contrition. He got the house arrest, and it was a much smaller sum of money, but, that held. You know, Corrine Brown, she demonstrated contrition at the end. I don't get the same sense, you know, based on their post, you know, conviction comments that these two defendants felt the same way.
Although I assume that at least, you know, after for Reggie Brown, after conversations with his attorney, I could see him appearing more contrite after that, after, you know, if it sinks in that there's a value to that. I personally always find that to be a weird little quirk of sentencing. I understand the reasoning behind it, but there is something of spending, you know, a period of time defending yourself, saying I didn't do it. And then once you get convicted, you're supposed to turn around and go, oh, well, okay, you got me. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's just weird. But it does make sense that it plays in the sense that the caller who talked about 30 days, you know, or house arrest, you don't want someone who's unrepentant, you know, getting a lighter sentence. If somebody is bound and determined to say, no, I'm fine, it's a natural human impulse to say, we'll throw the book at them.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on to another topic. You know, moving on from the Browns to President Donald Trump. He was in the Villages yesterday. Governor Ron DeSantis, a lot of GOP dignitaries were there. The story was Medicare. You know, Trump basically was defending Medicare as it is, a little bit of expansion there. And, you know, he was messaging against Medicare for all, you know, the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren healthcare plan. Shelton, I want to start with you on this. You know, President Trump coming to the Villages in the midst of an impeachment inquiry. Tell us about the optics there. Tell us what he's trying to do politically.
Well, I would assume part of it was just to relax. He wanted to be seen in front of a sympathetic environment, people that would respond to all his taglines, people with whom the anti-Medicare for all message might resonate. He seems to be doing things at the beat of his own drum. You know, there's no, whatchamacallit, there's no metronome going on with it. I don't think that any of this is really working for him, though. It looks fine in front of the TV cameras. It looks fine in front of that crowd. But what's going on in Washington is really like a whole separate thing. Now, as far as Medicare, I think the best thing he can do is continue to just sit back and let the Democrats pick at each other over their differences in Medicare policy, healthcare policy, and then just slide in later. As we've seen with the Ukraine thing, there's no need for the president to involve himself at all with what the Democrats are doing. He should just sit on his money, sit back, continue doing what he's doing, and wait till about August or perhaps next October, and then go ahead and drop the hammer.
Mm, okay. As an occasional student of history, I have to say that I did laugh when I read the quote that they want to raid Medicare to fund a thing called socialism. You know, if you look at the debate when the entire safety net was set up, that you know, creeping step towards socialism is with how it was viewed by some at the time. So the idea of, you know, keep your socialism out of my Medicare is darkly humorous.
Yeah, and Tim, you know, expanding on that a little bit, you know, when you look at the appeal there is to a 65 and over crowd. Seniors. There are people who elected Donald Trump. There are people who voted for Donald Trump in the state, got him over the hump. You know, but who loses when Medicare is guaranteed and bolstered for the current generation? I mean, don't we have a national debt? Don't we have an entitlement crisis happening? Don't we have these structural issues?
Different conversation. I would argue those are two different things. But no, I mean, clearly this is a crowd that is, A, they vote, and B, they're very much concerned about healthcare. So, you know, it is the perfect crowd to make this sort of argument in front of.
Okay. Nate, I want to go to you here. You know, President Trump, the Villages, you know, he does a lot of plays in Florida. He, you know, obviously he and Lenny Curry have an association. He and Governor Ron DeSantis, they were basically a two-man show. Why is Florida so important to President Trump, you know, I guess in terms of his messaging?
I mean, it is the nation's largest swing state. If Trump loses Florida, the math for him winning the Electoral College becomes, you know, daunting to mathematically impossible very quickly. In Florida, you know, it is, despite its reputation as a swing state, it is really remarkable how Republicans have been able to hang on in these just agonizingly narrow elections. You know, twice in a row now in 2016 and in 2018, you know, we saw Democrats with really every reason to win lose. And, you know, like my expectation given that is that Trump is very likely to win Florida again in 2020. You know, Florida may be a very closely divided state, but it is a red state. And it's one he has to keep in his he has to keep it in his back pocket. It is of existential importance.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, obviously this was booked as a policy event. It was not a political event. However, it had a feel of a rally, an hour long speech, touched on a lot of different topics, Russia investigation, Elizabeth Warren calling her Pocahontas on occasion, saying the Democrats are chasing impeachment for his reelection. You know, is the president abusing the platform or is it just basically the prerogatives of leadership?
AG, I'd like to hear you weigh in on that, frankly. That's, I mean, every event that he stages feels like a rally. I think that that's kind of a, you know, if there's one common theme in this presidency. And I think it's interesting that he's trying to plant the flag on an issue that the Democrats have made their central push of the next election, which is healthcare. He's going to try to claim some of that territory for himself, even though I think a lot of people would say he's done a lot to disable healthcare, you know, provisions and Obamacare.
He talked about that. He talked about, you know, undermining Obamacare yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, when you look at that, when you look at, you know, what the president is doing, you know, there's a gap between the messaging and the reality. Speaking of gaps between messaging and reality, Shelton, I want to go to you. You know, obviously a lot of Republican a lot of Republican politicians are fundraising off of this. Governor Ron DeSantis, he launched the Presidential Protection Fund. Rick Scott, Marco Rubio, they're fundraising. But Governor DeSantis is an especially interesting example. I mean, he's got an over 50% approval rating in the state. A lot of Democrats and independents still back him, although that's probably going to end soon. You know, so what's Governor DeSantis doing with his brand to help the president?
Well, I think what DeSantis is doing is kind of showing that he's just a loyal soldier, that he's grateful for the support that Trump provided him earlier. As far as his presidential protection fund, I'll call it right now. I guarantee you that indictments come out of that in about 2 years, probably. And a lot of it, and a lot of the Florida thing is psychological for the president because he's one of the few presidential nominees in history to lose his own hometown. So most presidents have some sort of geographic base where they can kind of feel like this is Clinton country or this is Bush country. Trump's country, he's not even that well liked there. So Florida has sort of emerged as is basically his de facto home territory. And just psychologically, given the pressure that his whole staff is under up there in Washington, you could see him, by Trump standards, calm down just a little bit when he was down here. And so it serves DeSantis well. He has nothing to worry about at this point.
I think that the question of Trump and DeSantis gets a little interesting when you talk about an advisor that was just fired, Susie Wiles, who helped deliver the state for Rick Scott, helped deliver the state for Trump, certainly, and then was recently dismissed by the governor because of suspicions, I guess he had, that she'd leaked some information about a not quid pro quo for golfing outings and
got very leaky
it.
There, yeah.
So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see where she steps in the Trump push for the next election.
And Susie, if you're listening, 904-549-2937 is the number to call in. Anybody else who wants to call in about Trump, impeachment, or we're talking about JEA a little later. You know, Nate, I want to talk a little bit about Susie Wiles because you know her pretty well. And, you know, she's obviously been sort of an architect of local political victories. You know, the pension reform, she's instrumental in that. Helped to get Rick Scott elected governor, helped to get Ron DeSantis elected governor. Thank you on both. But Susie seems to be sort of out of her element right now a little bit. She doesn't seem to have allies.
I don't know that she doesn't have allies so much as maybe just, you know, at the moment she's, you know, maybe sort of going underground for a little while. I mean, my read on Susie is that there are people who owe her quite a bit for things that she's done for them over the years. I mean, she's the kind of person who will help a politician out, you know, for free, give them advice and not charge them. And I think that goes a long way with people. I think she has a reservoir of goodwill with plenty of people in Tallahassee, certainly here in Jacksonville.
even in City Hall right now?
No one has good. I mean, you know, no one has goodwill at City Hall. They're, you know, if you're not, you know, one of like four people in the city of Jacksonville, you're not really on a, you know, on the good list.
Yeah. Tim, I want to get your take on Susie also.
I think there's also the reality of, you know, the comments that we were just talking about of how important Florida is for Trump. I think once the election heats up, whatever the rift is between DeSantis and Wiles goes away, because she has proven herself somebody who can deliver Florida. And I don't think, you know, personality conflicts is going to get in the way of that when it comes down to the actual election.
Okay, so you're predicting they make up.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's different strands in the Republican Party. I mean, the Scott and DeSantis, their camps had you know, disagreements and clashes. I mean, you look at the entire inauguration was just kind of a weird, you know, just again, personality clash. And this sort of thing happens. But yeah, end of the day, winning is what matters.
Okay, and Shelton, you got to take on Susie Wiles. I mean, what happens if she doesn't get let back in?
I don't think she's someone who has to be let back in. Like, she goes where she wants to go. It's like a Jedi mind trick, what she's accomplished so far. You know, Trump's odds of winning Florida are pretty good anyway. If I were him, I would just reach out to her and bring her up to the White House. She's one of the few people in regional politics here in Florida that could probably actually go up to Washington and be effective on that guy's behalf. She'd be a much better spokesperson than most of what they've had so far. And as far as the dispute between her and DeSantis, you know, she's a winner. She did what it took to get that guy into the governor's mansion, and people can complain about it now, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I want to move on to JEA, 549-2937 for your calls on this. We've got JEA news again this week. Two things to talk about. First of all, Councilman Matt Carlucci proposed a plan to earmark money from the proceeds of a potential sale. I said potential sale to pay for the utilities and funded pension liability. You know, Tim, when you're looking at the JEA issue and the JEA sale, sort of explain to us what's happening there with this proposal.
Well, there's a couple of different pieces here, and there are people on this panel more qualified than me to weigh in on the political side of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, the business case is simple. Aaron Zahn, the CEO, has come in and says that the sky is falling and JEA can't survive in as a municipally owned utility, and therefore it should be sold to people or persons unknown. And that's kind of just, you know, in a nutshell, the business part of it. It then quickly gets into the politics bit because of the way that entire idea has been floated. As you said, potential sale. Nobody at JEA is going to say that they want to sell it other than buying ads saying that they should sell it. Nobody is going to say that it has to be sold other than having board meetings where they say it has to be sold. So it becomes this weird, will we or won't we? We're not sure if we even want to do this, but everybody's acting like they're going to. And I think that's ticking people off.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the money here, $338 million in funded pension liability, Nate, you know, we got a $3.4 billion total in funded pension liability. You know, when they're talking a $3 billion sales price for JEA, that's their threshold. Did you expect the pension liability to be sort of offset by that, or do you expect it to be a liability that was passed on to a potential buyer?
Actually, that's a good question. I don't know that I had a specific expectation. Certainly, JEA could have stuck in this invitation to negotiate a requirement that the buyer absorb and take over those pension costs. I don't know why that wasn't part of it, but there's no reason they could not have asked a potential buyer to either consider doing that or to make that a mandatory part of, you know, the sort of minimum criteria. How it got passed on to the city is, you know, I think baffling to me and a lot of other people.
Yeah. I mean, and JEA's right now, they've got an ad sort of promoting the idea of this $3 billion. Are questionable optics to that? I mean, you know, Councilman Tommy Azuri's pointed out that they're sort of promoting the sale. Other people have said the same thing.
You know, the only way that you can look at that ad and come away with the conclusion that it is not promoting a sale is, I guess there are two ways. If you are being paid to argue that it's not promoting a sale, Or two, if you suspend all critical faculties and simply accept the explanation from the person who is being paid to say it's not promotional,
you can
maybe you can get there.
Yeah.
I mean, JEA is, as an entity, clearly pushing some sort of transaction. I mean, the ad references $3 billion improving everyone's lives. I mean, you know, the Sandman isn't going to give the city $3 billion. A private buyer is going to give the city $3 billion.
Yeah, and the ad refers to it as transformation as opposed to sale, which is, I think, just, you know, a strange linguistic.
If you are not somebody who's been following this and you see that ad, I really wonder what your takeaway is. Because your first takeaway would seem to be just to be baffled of why is JEA talking about transformation? Because it very carefully, it doesn't talk about a sale. It's this weird gauzy.
It is really the height of hypocrisy, though, that they are putting out an ad when they have essentially asked to silence all other parties, you know, including their employees, which thankfully the employees pushed back on and refused to accept that gag order. They've done the same with the city council, which I haven't seen a lot of pushback. I'm a little surprised that they're accepting this non-binding recommendation from their attorney, which nonetheless says that they absolutely have to maintain silence about the terms of any sale, which is, it's not looking like a super transparent process.
We covered a meeting with some city council people and the general counsel, and that was one of their big questions of, what is our role? And beginning to be rumblings of them getting outside counsel, which they're allowed to, unlike the school board, the idea of them getting outside counsel to advise them on this, because it really does seem to be a morass where the elected leadership of the city is, at least some members of it, feel like they're not being given the voice that they want to have or should have.
Yeah, I mean, that's a question. And Shelton, I want to get you in here as we close. When you look at the sort of the strategy here, the mayor's office has been kind of dominant. General counsel's office has been kind of dominant. They have got the school board held in check. It looks like the city council's basically knowing its role also. You know, when you look at this model of government, are there drawbacks? I mean, you live in Riverside, and your councilwoman, Randy DeFore, she issued criticisms of the general counsel, said there was a crisis. I'm going to ask you, is there a crisis in city government?
No more than usual. This is how business is traditionally done. The problem is that the Democratic Party here locally, through years of, won't say mismanagement, but through years of easily avoidable mistakes, have allowed the mayor to gain like a plurality on the on the council that makes it impossible for any real pushback to take form. And with the organization the size of JEA, I question, like I always have, I question the extent to which they'll be able to get fair market value for that organization. And I have no idea who's going to buy it, but if you gave me 500-1 odds right now, I would drop $100 on United Arab Emirates.
FPL's in the mix too.
Dubai has cash.
You know, speaking of cash, we got Isaiah from St. Augustine, who's been holding for a while. Isaiah, you want to talk about President Trump's impeachment. So go ahead and tell us what's on your mind.
Hi, my name is Isaiah. I'm calling in from St. Augustine. And the reason why I wanted to call in is because this Ukraine gate issue that's going on right now, obviously, that's not what Donald Trump did was not appropriate. However, I think harping on this issue for means of impeachment is going to be a losing argument. We've seen the Russiagate thing come and fail. Frankly, if we want to impeach Donald Trump, we need to focus on things that are actually affecting millions of people, which is one of the things is there's a genocide occurring in Yemen right now, which not a lot of people are talking about. We're arming Saudi Arabia, and they are currently waging a genocide, killing hundreds of thousands of people as we speak. There's a cholera epidemic in Yemen. There's a lot more things that we could be trying to impeach Donald Trump on. And I think Ukraine gate is going to be a failing issue.
Hey, thank you, Isaiah. I appreciate that call. I mean, there's a lot of untilled ground there with President Trump's impeachment. That's a story that's going to evolve. And obviously those issues the caller brings up are salient. I want to move on to something a little bit cheerier though. Minshew mania. Gardner Minshew has taken the NFL by storm, is stronger than ever. He's rookie of the month. The Jaguars are marketing a Minshew mini pack. I want to start with you, Ann. You know, you've never been a huge football fan, but
still not.
You know, Gardner Minshew. Does he pique your interest?
Not especially. I can't confess to being part of the mania, but I will say, you know, I think that this is a team that has long needed a narrative. And yeah. I think that this is the guy that, you know, there was a lot of people back in the day who wanted Tebow, and it wasn't because of his skill. It was because they were passionate about him as a person and a character in their story. And I think this is a guy in his like cut off jeans that fills that role for people.
Yeah. I mean, he's a lot of people say he's Duval to the core, and he just moved here. Nate, when you look at this, I mean, you moved here a few years ago, you saw the Bortles era in its full glory. You know, a lot of false hope. It just seems like things have turned a little bit. You know, but what does Minshew do in terms of branding for the city and also for people in the city? I mean, the mayor, he's a big football fan, et cetera.
We all are aware of that.
So, you know, when we look at with Gardner Minshew, I mean, whether the Jaguars go to the playoffs or not, what does this mean for the city?
Well, you know, full disclosure, I mean, I'm a Saints fan first. I'm from New Orleans, so, and who actually plays the Jaguars in a couple of weeks.
You'll see at the bank,
he can, yeah, he can, if Minshew, you know, collapses or whatever before then, that's fine. I mean, you know, to Ann's point, like, look, the city is a more fun place to be when the Jaguars are doing well. And, you know, there does, like, you know, the Saints were terrible for a long time when I was a kid. And that kind of like losing culture breeds a really fascinating kind of image that teams like fans kind of have about their team. And it's like fun in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, the Minshew stuff just kind of plays into that. These like interesting characters that we glom onto. And, you know, this kid may actually turn out to be a great quarterback. I mean, he seems pretty solid. So,
yeah, I think it's interesting when you talk about branding and to go on Ann's point about narrative, which I think is a perfect way of describing it, that Jacksonville's struggled on a national scale to actually, it's not just the winning and losing, it's actually having people, you know, care about the team either way. And I think that this, having a story, having a thing that, you know, national sports media can write about and make people just interested, not your hardcore football fans, but people who, you know, only think of Jacksonville as a laughingstock as a team, now have this. And in some ways, the winning and losing doesn't matter. It's having a story. Yeah. I'm also curious what it does for, you know, future seasons of The Good Place. Because, I mean, they got to do something. I mean, this is like made for them.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, I mean, the franchise stability issue has always been a question here. The Jaguars are in the bottom quarter of, you know, revenue, of attendance, all of these things. That's why we've got the London presence. You know, Tim, I mean, the city's invested bigly in the Jacksonville Jaguars. You know, the stadium improvements, whatever the Lot J deal cost. You know, is Gardner Minshew a way to justify those costs? I mean, because if he can get actual home fans into the stadium.
That's always the problem. You talk to economists, the idea of city-built stadiums are never economically justified, just on a return on investment dollar value sort of thing. The only way to make them worthwhile as an investment is kind of the aura around them, that the Jaguars being here makes Jacksonville have a bigger presence. We might not see direct dollar for dollar ROI, but we have a thing. And yeah, so that the narrative does play into that, that if you have a team that people are more excited about, you have a team that people are paying more attention to, that's worth money in and of itself.
Yeah, and Shelton, I mean, let's talk about the narratives with the team itself. I mean, Jalen Ramsey, he dominated the news. He's still dominating the news with that. You know, he wants to be traded, but Shad Khan doesn't want to trade him. You know, Gardner Minshew's sort of the flip side of that narrative. You know, he didn't pull up in a Brinks truck. He pulled up in jean shorts. Yep. You know, is there an authenticity to Gardner Minshew, or is it just they're kind of two sides of the same coin?
They're very similar. I think it's examples of how young men deal with sudden fame and the pressures related to it. I think what makes Minshew so appealing is that our team is now led by a guy who was never designated to be a leader. He fell into this position by accident, and he's just sort of done what he's done through hard work.
It's almost like a CEO.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, as to Jalen Ramsey, I would say if Ramsey didn't leak the news that he wanted to be traded, then he should probably fire his agent, because that really made him look bad. In terms, you know, you talk about the branding of the team long term. I think he'll stay, and hopefully the Jaguars can make a deep playoff run If we won the Super Bowl, I don't even know what would happen. It would probably it would render all talk of climate change moot by the time the riot was finished.
Yeah, I mean, probably so. And, you know, when we look at it, we've got two home games coming up for the Jaguars, the Saints coming up, the Jets. There's Minshew mini packs. They're selling tickets, and they've got gimmicks, mustaches and things like that. You know, we're seeing a lot of the branding around town.
I think it's interesting that we've got, like, these dueling mustaches at the bank right now. It's like, who's going to, you know, win the facial hair war between Shad Khan and Minshew?
And Movember is coming right around the corner.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So there's your tie-in.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, Jaguars is always ahead of their time.
Khan is the eighth richest pro sports team owner in the country, so I'm pretty sure he'll win, you know. He'll just buy Minshew's mustache.
But Minshew now has the fifth most popular jersey in the NFL.
Yeah, there you go. It is. Wow. It's a fight.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, Jaguars, they've had a lot of adversity over the years, but this seems like a good storyline. I want to do a quick 30-second each lightning round, something you want to talk about this week. Anne, is there something we missed?
Oh, God. I wish I could say that there was something we missed. I will say that we did sit down with Minshew's dad yesterday at our station, which I thought was kind of an interesting look at, like, the papa patriarch of the now legendary quarterback. And it was very cute.
Nate?
I got nothing.
All right. Thanks so much. Tim?
Public development in San Marco. It's been literally a decade plus in the making, and it's finally moving forward. Be a big story. I mean, there was movement this week, but if you're interested in real estate news, that really is going to be a massive project moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the whole region is starting to take off with the apartments.
The apartments there, I mean, partially it's the Opportunity Zone stuff, but I mean, there is that part of Jacksonville is going to just explode in the next 18 months.
Yeah, that was a big deal for Lori Boyer when she was on council and was coming to fruition. Shelton, is there anything we missed this week?
Kareem 2023, everyone loves a comeback.
It sounds like we got a campaign manager there. Okay, it's time for Only in Florida. You know, let's go ahead and cue up that theme. And this is a different edition, a sort of sentimental edition where we're looking at something that is not funny, but is real. Earlier this week, thousands of folks attended the funeral for a Florida man who died without family, and he was a veteran. Most of them were strangers. They turned out to pay their respects to Edward Pearson, who was buried with military honors at Sarasota National Cemetery. They came out after a funeral director posted a death announcement for Pearson online. This veteran has no immediate family. All are welcome to attend. The post went viral, shared thousands of times on social media, drawing people and media from across the state. You know, when you look at that, you know, what did that do to your heart, Anne?
Well, the music is flying in the face of the very strong sentiment of your words. It's kind of distracting, frankly. But, you know, that was a really interesting story. I think it was a little bit, heartwarming for people to see that people cared about this guy in memoriam.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful story, and people really came through for him. Okay, I want to thank the panel, Nate Monroe from Florida Times Union, Shelton Hull, Folio Weekly, Ann Schindler of First Coast News, and Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Thank you so much.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
ViStar Credit Union is a financial cooperative focused on delivering quality financial services for its members. ViStar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or on the web at vistarcu.org. Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Our most basic instinct is to protect our families. Safety belts and properly installed child seats do that. They prevent injuries and deaths.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Last week, a billionaire California couple made one of the largest ever donations to an American university. The gift was for research into climate change and environmental sustainability.
I've not really seen kind of a huge donations like that happening.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, Climate Philanthropy, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Do you have a recipe for gluten-free bread that, well, just falls flat? Are your baguettes bogged down with water? I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we're loading up on carb science with tips and tricks to enrich your homemade bread recipes. Got a bread baking problem? Science may have the answer on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
How was your week?
Vicious.
We're not fooling around here, though.
Vicious.
You give the American people a choice between freedom and socialism.
When people are buying ads and they're paying you in rubles,
they're going to choose freedom every time.
Questions remain over who asked whom to do what and whether that included snakes and alligators at the southern border. The Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Wants to join the FBI. Her troubled past torments her psyche. Her daddy died when she was nine.
Welcome back. Or should I say, hello, Clarice. It's been described as irreverent. It's definitely not for children, not for the faint of heart. It's Silence, the musical, and it's based on Silence of the Lambs film. Joining us now to share details on the show's final weekend, there's one show left that you can buy tickets for. And what else is coming up at the Five and Dime is Lee Hamby, managing director of the Five and Dime and the director of the show. Lee, good to have you here.
Good morning.
If you don't know about Silence of the Lambs, the musical, here's what you need to know. It's a musical satire of the classic movie, The Silence of the Lambs. Rookie FBI agent Clarice Starling matches wits with Dr. Hannibal Lecter, catching a serial killer. This version has less horror and more hilarity, compete with a chorus of singing lambs throughout the show. Lee, where do you find singing lambs?
So lots of people actually showed up for this audition to be lambs and all these other characters because everybody knows the film. I say everybody, most people know the film. So we... you know, we're always looking for unique things to do at the Five and Dime. Usually, if you know the Five and Dime, we love to tell those strong, poignant stories or heartbreaking stories. But we like to throw in a couple of things like Silence, the musical, to lighten everybody's mood. So, yeah.
Yeah. And there are tickets available for the Saturday at 11 p.m. show. I want to stress that.
Yeah, that's the only performance that has tickets left. We're sold out tonight. We're sold out tomorrow at 8 p.m. 11 p.m. is the only show with tickets still left.
I mean, this is such a hot show. You got to get there, people. I want to ask you about casting iconic characters, because the Hannibal Lecter character, Clarice Starling character, they're film icons with Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins. You know, how did you go about casting? What are the challenges as a director?
The thing about this show is, and it being a parody, you don't have to really worry that much. And I kind of did, because I wanted it to be as close to what people visualized as possible. But it's kind of hard to do that. And with the show, the characters are they're different, because Hannibal Lecter has to sing like an opera singer, has to have a legit voice. So there's that too. So you have to really, you know, you want that iconic look, and we do give you that with the costumes and the, you know, he has the mask on for part of the show and things like that. And Clarice has her, lisp, if you will, and her country, you know, southern accent. So there are those elements that people look for, and I really did look for those people that could do that really well, and everybody came out of the woodwork to audition and wanted to be a part of this crazy, wacky show.
Yeah, I mean, as a director, I mean, it's good to have almost an embarrassment of riches. We've got a really good theater community.
We do.
And, you know, but when you were directing this, you're staging this kind of show. Obviously, you talked about singing lambs. What are the other visual elements that people can expect?
There are lots of musical numbers that the lambs sing and dance. So what happens in the show is the chorus of lambs play all the different characters, like Dr. Chilton. You have Catherine Martin, the girl in the well. You have Catherine's mother. They play all these other, all the FBI people. They play all the characters. So the lambs are really, they work their butts off in the show.
Is it like a Greek chorus kind of thing?
It is exactly what it is.
Okay, cool. So obviously you get one shot at this, and fiveanddime.org is the place where you'd want to go. The words fiveanddime.org if you want to get tickets. But if you're not able to make it this weekend, you got some great stuff coming up next. Yeah. And what's coming up this month?
So next, actually on Sunday, exciting news, is on Sunday at 2 o'clock we have our 2020 season announcement shindig is what we're calling it. And we have some food and drinks, and people can come hear about all the new shows that are happening for our new season that starts in January. And then up next, we have a stage reading of Love, Valor, Compassion, directed by Joe Kemper. And that opens only 3 days only, October 17th, 18th, and 19th.
Okay.
That's up next.
And a Reader's Theater staged reading, is that basically people reading the script?
It is. So we kind of pick shows that we either might want to do later, or shows that are either too big for our stage. And we want to tell that story, but we're not able to give the full production. And so it really gives an opportunity for the audience to visualize and use their own imagination to see what the full production could be.
Yeah.
And people really love that.
You're working in a black box theater, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really great space to see something. Harvest, November 9th. Tell us about The Harvest.
The Harvest, it talks about religion, and it really is a very strong story. We've done a play by this playwright, Samuel D. Hunter. We did a play called The Whale. And if you've seen that show, you'll know this show is not as hard to watch as that, but it really is a slice of life play, talking about missionaries and religion and how religion affects people.
Yeah, and then 2019 is going to close out with some great performances, a Singer's Choice Cabaret. What are people going to be singing? What can people expect from that?
So we are really successful with our cabarets, and we get so many, like you said just a minute ago, we're so many talented people in Jacksonville, and we give the people the opportunity to sing what they want and what really speaks to them. Yeah.
All right. That's our program. Fiveanddime.org. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield, our digital editor. I'm A.G. Gankarski, filling for Melissa Ross. We'll be back. Have questions or comments on First Coast Connect? Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wgct.org. And this replays again at 8 o'clock p.m. on 89.9. We'll be on the web also. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back at 9 a.m. on Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.